Hey everyone, this is John.
This is Wes.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo Show 64, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. Like the name implies, we're going to talk about an N64 game.
Ooh.
And we do this sort of like semi-chronologically. We reach back into the year of 2000. We're up to the year 2000. February of 2000, to be exact. And we talk about the stuff that happened. Mostly try to focus on at least a video game, but...
Should we keep calling it 64 show? Because, I mean, at this point...
Yes.
All right.
Well, I think John keeps us honest. He keeps bringing some N64 stuff to discuss. And I hope I didn't... I just, you know...
No, we do.
Drop you there. I hope you do have something.
We have an and it's Pokemon Stadium. We're going to talk about some Pokemon Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is...
I was going to bring mine out. Oh, I completely forgot. You forgot to write my name, John.
That's okay. Yeah, but I think we should plug this in because it's actually more of a substantial package than I thought it was going to be.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot going on.
That's what she said.
Yes,
it's just... We can't walk out that episode. That was a good, that's what she said.
We're all aware of your aggressively long penis.
Did you say it was an exceptional package?
So, but before we get to that, there are a couple of other games that I think are worth mentioning because to give the context in which this game came out. But I think I'm going to try a little bit of a different format. Usually what we do is we kind of move through chronologically. We'll start with games because there's three games that I think are worth mentioning, and then we'll move into the non-game stuff. That way, if someone is listening just to hear us, you know, wax idiotic about video games, they can do that and then they can leave.
Yeah.
But I like talking about the movies and all the other stuff, so we're still going to do that. It's fun.
You'll put timestamps in the show notes, I'm sure.
No, absolutely not. the show notes are usually just like, we talked about this, the end.
Yeah.
Except the...
I really hope you do fish it with the end every time.
I might now.
John would just be like the worst court stenographer.
it's just like... People gave testimony. He clearly did it. The last show notes I did.
Number five's got wonderful cans.
I keep it professional.
Hey, you know.
The show notes for the last show were John and Wes have a rational discussion about games. Ryan maliciously and ignorantly maligns Xenoblade.
Wow. And I can't believe I went on for as long as I did.
But that was my revenge.
Man, that was a...
I was in pain. I was in physical pain.
I was feeling ways about stuff.
I didn't sleep that night. I couldn't, like, it was going through. And, you know, I wanted to fight you.
You're just, like, combing Dunban's hair. Like, don't listen to him. Don't listen to him,
you're
sweetheart.
You're beautiful. No, I might as well take this end. I wanted to fight you on certain things, but I've said my piece about Xenoblade. You deserve a forum to do it as well. You can say whatever you want about it. You don't have to like the same thing.
You guys have clocked, like, a solid 3 or 4 hours of content out of that.
I'm going to mash it all together
and
do a Xenoblade show that way. But I was also very sleep deprived, so I was having some very strong emotions, and I was like, do I really, like, am I really that offended by what he's saying, or do I just need to go to sleep?
I did make my point clear, right, that I think it is a good game, and it deserves its very high rating. I personally didn't enjoy it, and I think
you did not make that point clear at all.
No, not one bit. No, the game is exceedingly well reviewed by fans and critics, and it justifies it. But man, it is a boring fucking game. And they could have done a lot to make it, you know, like, genuinely enjoyable. We don't have to get back into this. We're getting back into this.
Speaking of boring games. Speaking of boring games.
This is a terrible, horrible, boring game, but I can see why it's good. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Speaking of boring games.
Speaking of boring games.
21 years ago, in February of 2000, what a time to be alive it was, The Sims was released. This was the first Sims game developed by Maxis and published by EA. This is where it started.
Did I ever tell you the creepy thing that Mitch did with The Sims?
Please.
So, I used to live with Mitch. Those of you who have been part of the show for 10 years would know Mitch.
Yeah, I think he's been on like 2 podcasts.
Yeah, over the course of like 6 years ago. But my roommate, I walked into his room one day, like, hey, do you want to play some Battlefield or whatever? And he was playing Sims, and his character is this big, out-of-shape guy with long white hair and wearing a band t-shirt and shorts. And he goes to talk to a girl convinces her to, you know, come back to the house. Takes her into the house and then blocks her off into a room that has a big mirror for a wall. Sets up the table in front of the mirror. And you can see his character sitting there eating a bowl of cereal while watching this girl through the window.
Oh, you have talked about this before.
Not a mirror, it's a window. I'm telling this story horribly.
I have talked to others. He was being a creeper in the game.
Yeah, he was being a creeper in the game. Just getting his perv on. It was funny because the game, you know, clearly didn't know what to do with this type of thing because the girl's like on the cell phone and just like, oh, just
are they, like doing like their Sims like nonsense talk,
which is funny.
They probably didn't have someone be there like, okay, well, why don't you program the serial killer behavior stuff into the game? So how do the characters react when they find out that every person playing this game is going to act like a serial killer?
Yeah, that you're now kidnapped in a small room where the floor is just tile.
I gotta confess, I've never played a Sims game.
Neither have I.
I tried it. I cannot get into it.
Well, it's a hugely influential game. Sort of the original like life simulation thing. We're not going to do a deep dive into this. I don't have much on it. But one interesting thing that I did read about this game is Will Wright, who was kind of the lead designer, sort of the brainchild behind all the Sim games, SimCity, et al. He had a hard time getting this project off the ground. He actually started working on this game in 1991. So 9 years previous, right after he did Sim Ant, and it never focus tested well. People thought it was boring, this sort of life simulation. So it took him 9 years to actually get it released, and yet to great acclaim. Like, it was one of the best, most influential, I should probably say, life sim games. Kind of created a genre in that way.
Yeah, Sim nowadays has a bunch of different expansions and everything. There's like the Sim Pets expansion, there's the Star Wars expansion, there's Island Living expansion. Like,
yeah,
calm the fuck down, guys.
EA really EA'd it.
Yeah.
But on to some more interesting games that came out in February of 2000. Resident Evil Code Veronica.
That was a great game.
Out on the Sega Dreamcast.
Nice.
Yep. I don't know if you guys know, but I like this game. This game's pretty cool.
You know what? Me too.
Yeah.
Great game. You got Steve tattooed where on your body?
Steve burns out everywhere. Just his face over mine. I fucking hate that guy. Fuck Steve.
What do you think it is? Do you think it's like the leopard print on his gear or the fact that he has like two German Nazi issued weapons as his default guns?
Do you think he's prettier than you?
I think he's just so fucking obnoxious.
He has a collar, doesn't he? Doesn't he wear like an actual
choker? Yeah, he wears a choker.
Wow.
Oh, God.
And I don't think that's like prison issue, because he's like a prisoner on the island that Claire finds herself on, that she's being incarcerated into.
Yeah, it would be like if you went into the Sims game and you just randomed everything.
Military pants, choker, and a sleeveless button-down shirt.
It's funny. Steve. I have a hard time picturing Steve because I never played the game. And I sent you like 15 photos of him on the phone. And
it's
like,
funny how.
What does Steve look like? He has a choker.
It's funny. Anytime this game gets brought up, the game you haven't played, you're always like, "Oh yeah, Steve. He's like not even that important of a character."
I just know that you hate him. That's why I bring it up. Hmm.
But the game itself is very good. It's probably my personal favorite Resident Evil. It has a few little interesting tidbits about its development. Of course, a development published by Capcom. The development originally started back in 98 when they were trying to make it a Sega Saturn game. So this was the first Resident Evil game where they were trying to put it on a system that wasn't PlayStation. The Sega Saturn is notoriously not a good system for 3D games. It was built with making really high-quality pixel art in mind, which may be the reason, one of several reasons why the Sega Saturn never really took off. And by the time they started development, Capcom, on a Resident Evil game for the Saturn was pretty much dead and buried in North America. By 1998-1999, Sega was outright canceling projects in North America and not bothering to localize games that were already released in Japan. A couple of examples of this, like The Shining Force 3 was like a trilogy of games, and they never ended up finishing that out in North America because it wasn't worth it to put games on the system anymore. And also, Panzer Dragoon Saga, which is another RPG that was real late in the Saturn life cycle, was a game that pretty much like two guys who worked at Sega, like in their off hours, had to finish localizing so they could like actually release it for the system. And then, you know, they weren't like doing this under the table or anything, but Sega was not interested at all in supporting them to get this game released. So Code Veronica makes the jump over to Dreamcast, but when it was originally being developed at the Saturn, it was supposed to be the third entry in the Resident Evil franchise, so it was supposed to be Resident Evil 3, but they ended up swapping the titles, making this one Code Veronica, the sort of spin-off title, and then Resident Evil 3 starring Jill Valentine and beloved character Carlos in Raccoon City became Resident Evil 3 when that was originally intended to be the spin-off. But it kind of makes more sense that sort of the Raccoon City sort of storyline is confined to like the trilogy, like the numbered games.
I feel like it makes more sense as is, and this is also a departure in the way the game plays too, and the way the camera moves. Code Veronica feels very different than the other Resident Evil games.
Yeah, Code Veronica, to your point, it doesn't have the pre-rendered backgrounds anymore. It has the fully rendered 3D spaces. The camera is still in fixed positions, but is dynamic, so it will kind of pan and move with you at certain points. But then, of course, there are the points where, like, hey, this part is, there's going to be a camera shift. It doesn't really occur a whole lot, except when you're in some long corridors. But for the most part, a lot of rooms that you are in, there are there's a fixed camera angle that's going to follow you around through most of the room at that angle. There's not a whole lot of instances where it's going to whip around and drastically change on you. Yeah. It still uses the tank controls, of course, because it's kind of the most wieldy way to control a character in that sort of space where you have these fixed angles. But the backgrounds, you get a little bit more interaction with them. You also don't have that sort of visual effect where it looks like a polygonal character move around on a flat background, which, you know, they don't... It's not super obvious in a game like Resident Evil 2. They do a good job of sort of painting the background to where it blends in pretty well. But there are a couple of moments in especially Resident Evil 1 and Resident Evil 2, usually when you're outdoors, where you see this is obviously just a character moving across a screen and everything else is just flat. So, I forgot where I was going with this. Anyway.
Claire's pretty.
Yeah, Claire, she's a dynamite lady. I do like Claire. She's probably my favorite Resident Evil character.
She's special. She's a good girl.
Yeah. But so this
one, it's Claire and who?
Chris. So this one, it's a little bit different from other Resident Evils. In Resident Evil 1 and 2, you have two different characters that you pick from, and the way you play the game is going to change slightly depending on who you're playing. Resident Evil 2 also has that, but then there's also an A and B side of every scenario that you're playing. So if you start out as Leon, you can then play again as Claire in sort of a part 2. And then if you start as Claire, you can then play as Leon in a part 2. And Leon A and Leon B, Claire A and Claire B will all be slightly different from each other in the way that items are placed or characters they're interacting with. So there's a lot to go back to.
So it's worth doing four run-throughs.
Yeah. Resident Evil 2 is a highly replayable game because of all the different scenarios that you're able to go through.
Code Veronica though
is just locked. You're going to start as Claire, and you're going to get to a little bit past the halfway point, and then you're going to take over as Chris, and you don't get any sort of a swapping going on. It's just you're playing as this character in this section. This character in this section is going to be the same every time you play through it.
Do they meet up eventually?
They do.
Yes. They have wonderful children together. I do.
They're related.
They're siblings.
Oh, all right.
So they do not.
Same question. Okay.
But there is heavily implied incest in this game.
Oh.
Not with Claire and Chris, with two other sibling characters.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about those creepy people.
The Ashford twins. Alexia and Alfred. Yeah, they're a couple of creeps. I really like the outlandish plot in this one. Incest aside, it's also very it's Hitchcockian in some pretty blatant ways, without getting into spoilers for this 21-year-old game.
Cockian, I see what you did.
Yeah. So yeah, and these when you look at
Gay Ryan,
good lord,
Resident Evil 1, 2, 3, of course they're all very silly plots. There's this viral outbreak. There's zombies roaming around because of this virus, and monsters chasing you, and this guy who wears shades even at night chasing around as well. But they're not quite as, I suppose, bombastic as they really crank it up to in Code Veronica. There are some blatantly just silly characters.
Well, this is also the era of, like, Metal Gear, mm-hmm. where I think Metal Gear really went all in on just having this grand story with all sorts of crazy, like, American... like espionage action movie stuff, but then also having these ridiculous over-the-top characters that all are like kind of secretly like supervillains in their own weird ways. Like they all have powers that make them larger than life, you know. So I feel whenever I play these old Resident Evil games, I actually feel very much something in line with a Metal Gear game.
I think I think that's probably on point because Metal Gear, of course, Metal Gear Solid, a very influential game. Especially in the stealth action franchise, but then just also the way it conveys this narrative that's trying very much to be like this high-minded, tangled web that you're trying to unweave.
That's true, and the villains themselves, you know, while there is that Umbrella Corp, a lot of the characters you're interacting with are just weird.
Yeah.
It's true. There are some oddball out-there characters that don't feel like they're the, you know... evil one staring at all of the monitors in the room, like with the cat in their lap or whatever, being evil.
Right? Even some of, like the
they're just like they're fucking incest kids.
Yeah,
even like the, kids like the even like the hero characters, like Barry's kind of an odd duck.
It's the less popular Cabbage Patch Kids line up.
The incest kids.
Yeah, the incest kids.
They got like six fingers.
Yeah,
just like a claw at the end of one elbow.
One side of their face just droops a little.
Yeah. So, I really like this game. Resident Evil 3, I want to go back to a point that you were making, is also a very different, not in the way like it's presented, but Resident Evil 3 is not like just confined to a space in the way that you think of like the mansion in the original Resident Evil or the police station in Resident Evil 2. Resident Evil 3, to kind of stretch it out a little bit more, you have like these very deliberately like way that you're connecting like Raccoon City streets and buildings, but it's meant to feel larger in scope. And also they mess with some like ammo mechanics and the way like you craft ammunition, and the ammunition that you're crafting is going to have a dynamic effect on how the game is going to react to you. Kind of in the similar way that Resident Evil 2, the more guns you pick up, the harder the game's going to get. In Resident Evil 3, the sort of better ammunition that you're crafting for yourself, the more Nemesis is going to show up to try to fuck you up. There's nothing really like that in Code Veronica, but it does kind of try to give you a bigger scope that Resident Evil 3 also does. It gives you a bigger sense of space when you're going through like the prison and the residence. They still don't fundamentally change all that much the way that you're progressing the game. It's still a very like lateral sort of progression where you're getting things and backtracking and managing your inventory and managing your ammunition. And the more you replay these games, the more you get the rhythm of like, okay, I want to use this weapon in this scenario, but I also want to make sure I have this backup weapon because there's going to be a boss coming up that I can dispatch pretty easily with this.
Just get the infinite rocket launcher.
Just always carry around the rocket launcher and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Just there's like a mean dog coming at you to hit it with a rocket launcher. Yeah,
pretty much.
There's a dog jump scare. Those are in every Resident Evil game, it seems.
Or you get the shotgun with the wasp shells that just shoots a bunch of wasps.
And Nemesis isn't there just like swatting. Like, not the bees!
There's a grenade you can get in Dragon Age that's literally just a jar of bees.
Really?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
That's cool.
Fantastic.
Good story. I know.
So what Resident Evil 3 and Resident Evil Code Veronica don't do is they don't really like give you like, here's your cache of keys, and you're going to use these to open different doors throughout the mansion. And what that kind of does in Resident Evil and Resident Evil 2 is it gives you sort of this seemingly non-linear way that you're moving throughout. Okay, I can use this key in four different places. Let's see where it's going to work out the best, like go in what order. In Code Veronica, there are a couple of items that you get. You can use it in like place A or place B, and what you're doing in those areas is going to change the way you're progressing through the rest of the game. But for the most part, you're going to have very specific places you're using these items, and a lot of them are just one-time use things, which I think works out a lot better for inventory management. You're never having to carry too many things at one point because, you know, you unlock the door that you found the thing for and you throw it away. I think Resident Evil 4 will continue carrying this idea forward, even though there isn't so much like the item management for your keys to unlock your doors in Resident Evil 4. Is very much more like, hey, you found this thing in this one room. It is going to unlock the door directly in front of you.
Also, Resident Evil has a tendency to like that grid inventory system, which, by the way, I think is great. I'm surprised more games don't do this. It's a weird sort of forced economy of the way that you have to manage your space. It's a much more fun thing to toy around with in a Tetris sense than sort of like saying, I can only equip 100 pounds. Everything has weight, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's just...
No, I agree with you there. It's a more interesting inventory system.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think for a game like a horror game, it makes a lot of sense to give you, you know, the scarcity of ammo, the scarcity of inventory space. So, you know, you have to... There's that tension there. Like, do I have the right things with me? Am I going to have to go back to get more of it and then potentially put myself in a dangerous situation again that I...
I mean, because that sombrero is 4x4 spaces.
Yeah.
And you got to look good, but you need guns. It's a real trade-off. You really got to figure out
how you can't wear it all the time, because then it's going to get, you know,
can spoiled. Could I just charm the zombies?
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I like the sort of way that they manage the inventory in Code Veronica, because you do have to make those choices about, okay, what sort of equipment am I going to... take with me? What sort of, okay, am I going to take any healing items with me? And what sort of, like, where am I headed next and what items do I need to take? But I think that Code Veronica does a really good job of, you know, if you have a destination in mind and you have the stuff that you need to get there, like, by the time when you've unlocked that destination, you've unlocked the door, the thing that you needed to get there, you can just discard. So then you, like, have that inventory space freed up to collect things that are there.
Can I bring up one thing real quick?
Yeah, please.
So, in September of 1999, also released on the Dreamcast, House of the Dead 2.
Okay.
So, over the course of less than 6 months, you really get your zombie fill here on the Sega Dreamcast.
Yeah, the Dreamcast had, you know, a good amount of support of solid software for, you know, about a year or so. Like, it burned hot and fast, and then it died.
Yeah.
Well, it died because of the...
rampant pirating from people like me.
Yeah, the rampant... Much. Well, then... And the PlayStation 2. Like, Sony did a really good job marketing the PlayStation 2 and convincing people, like, nah, don't buy that. Just hold out for this. So...
You can just burn all the games you want for free.
Well, you know, for good reason. Because the PlayStation 2 had a lot of games.
Yeah.
Like, they really brought it. But yeah, that's Code Veronica. I really like it.
Yeah.
Some cool characters on it. The Bandersnatch. I like that guy a lot. With the one big arm.
You can tell what he does in his off time.
Yes. So
it's kind of it's a bit of a retread. I mean, in Birkin, when he becomes the giant thing, he's got the big eyeball on one shoulder with the arm as well.
Yeah, he's kind of like a cross between like Birkin and Clayface from the Batman animated series.
Yeah. Or the Sam Raimi live action series.
Oh, yeah.
Let's not forget that. Oh, no, Sandman. I'm sorry. Sorry for bringing that up.
So... these things actually behave in kind of a funny way, because the most efficient way, I'm going to get into this for a second, the most efficient way to take out a Bandersnatch is with your bowgun darts mixed with some explosive arrows. They do a lot of damage. It's one of your most useful weapons of the game, just for pumping out raw damage, because they shoot quickly and they do a lot of damage.
So one of the most effective weapons of the game is a blowgun?
A bowgun.
Bowgun. I thought you said blowgun. I was like, what the fuck?
No. It hasn't gotten that weird yet. So...
Just wait till Resident Evil 8. It's going to be a
giant vampire lady with a blowgun.
It's going to be a fucking roller coaster, yes.
So, Bandersnatches, when they take damage, they go into a stun animation. And you can still deplete their HP when they are stunned, but they won't go into a death animation. Even if they go HP down to zero, if they're still in their stun animation. So... the best way to take them out is with these bowgun arrows, these explosive arrows. Two of them will deplete their HP to zero, but because they're so fast, if you hit them fast really quick, the two of them, they're still in their stunt animation, so even if their HP is down to zero, because you took it down to zero when they were stunned, they're not dead. So they become these even further undead creatures. But then just, like, doing any sort of damage will take them out. But if you are really looking to conserve all of your ammo, the best way to do it is to aim, fire, lower your gun, raise your gun again, aim, and fire. That way...
It's like switching to pistol is faster than reloading, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
By the way, credit to Resident Evil that you literally just had to say the phrase, even more undead. Like, what a great series.
Yep. So good. But yeah, Code Veronica, thumbs up. It did come out on the GameCube, I think, in 2002, to kind of keep things Nintendo-related. A lot of Dreamcast games ended up getting ported off to other systems, especially the PS2 and the GameCube.
Did this come out on the N64?
No. Code Veronica never made it out on N64.
This is the 64 show, John.
Yeah. God damn it, John. We're putting things in the context of their time. So Pokemon Stadium came out right next to Code Veronica. But this was the stuff happening on other systems when Nintendo was putting out games like Pokemon Stadium. This game was a Pokemon game actually developed by Nintendo as well as HAL Studios.
Hmm.
I don't think it would be much of a stretch to sort of posit, to conjecture, that Nintendo really wanted a Pokemon game on their N64 in the year 2000. Gen 1 Mania was in full swing. The Pokemon Red and Blue, I think, came out in 98 in North America, and then Pokemon Yellow was in 99 in North America. And people loved Pokemon in all of its forms. And you had a really successful handheld in the Game Boy, where it sold really well. And you had a home console system that was doing okay in North America, but was pretty much a non-presence in Japan. So I don't think it'd be, you know, too outlandish to think, like, hey, this kind of Nintendo's way to get a bigger foothold and to maybe push some more units, even though, you know, you're getting to the last couple of years of its life cycle. But rather than doing a traditional Pokemon JRPG, they made Pokemon Stadium, which is just kind of a series of gym battles.
That's pretty much all it is.
So, you know, it is like an RPG in terms of, like, hey, it has battles, that's your primary game mechanic, but it doesn't have the sort of, you know, going out into the world, exploring, catching, you know, getting all your HMs to continue to press in the game. It's just, here's your 80-ish kind of scripted battles against, you know, Kanto gym leaders, the Elite Four, the champion, there's some junior trainers you have to get through, and they split all these battles into different cups. Do you remember much about those, Wes?
Not a whole lot. All I can remember is there's the gym challenge you could do where you had to go through a bunch of trainers to get to the gym leader. And then after that, you moved on to the next gym. But there's also a little side stuff you can do where you're only allowed to use Pokemon within level 1 to 30 or something like that. Yeah. There's like the Petite Cup or whatever else they were called. I forget what they were called. But there's other things like that where there's stipulations
the
about...
The Pika Cup and... Yeah, there's a couple more.
There's stipulations about which Pokemon you could select. Because the game, you never caught your own Pokemon, you never trained your own Pokemon, so it just gave you, like, access to the 150, and you just kind of picked your own team and went with it.
Yeah, so what you end up doing is you can, like you were saying, you can either, like, choose from these rental Pokemon.
Yes.
And you don't really get a whole... As far as I remember, you don't really get a whole lot of control over, like, their moveset or anything.
You don't. It's a preset moveset with those guys. You can, though... I will bring it up now. There was an attachment that you could purchase that snapped on the back of the N64 controller where you could pop your Game Boy Pokemon game, your Red, Blue, and Yellow... and download your team and use that in game.
Yeah, transfer pack. And it actually came packaged with the game originally.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that part.
Yeah, it was kind of the big features. You can now, like, take your Pokemon into this 3D battle thing.
Which was cool. I'd done it a couple of times, but I was a kid and the team really wasn't that developed. And so I always found the rental team being better than the team I used. Just because, you know, I didn't know what else.
Yeah, they really got those effort values pumped into the right places.
Yeah, like, they're just like, why are my guys exploding in every single turn? And
it's because he's still got Growl on there.
I don't know.
So, like you're saying, you bring in your own using the transfer pack. And the transfer pack, God, I can't remember if it was the transfer pack or actually the cart of the game. But what the transfer pack basically does is it loads the ROM so that your N64 can run it. The transfer pack or the game, one or the other, actually has an emulator for Pokemon Red, Blue, Yellow in there. And because there's an emulator in there, you could actually use the transfer pack to play the Game Boy game on your TV.
And I did that a couple of times.
I'm sure the resolution was just terrible.
Yeah, it was yeah.
But what you do, like you were saying, like that gym leader castle mode, you take on your junior trainers, your leaders, and your champion, you go through a bunch of battles, and when you get to the end, if you win, you get a prize Pokemon that you could then transfer back to your Game Boy game.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's a way that you can fill out your Pokedex if you don't have friends. So you can get like any of the three starters. You can get a Hitmonlee or Hitmonchan, an Eevee. You can even get one of the two fossils.
Can you do this multiple times and get more? Okay.
Yeah, you can run through it multiple times and get them because the prize Pokemon that you get is chosen at random.
Oh, shit.
So, yeah, you could potentially, like, in your original game, start with a Charmander.
And get a Charmander.
And get a Charmander. And then run through it again and get another Charmander.
Ugh.
I'm not sure what level it gives it to you, but you know you are getting the first form, so you can fill out the Pokedex.
There's
that
a Rattata. Like,
yeah.
Oh,
and it is cool that they give you this way to sort of like purchase, pay to win, pay to complete your Pokedex in this. So it's kind of a cool little bonus, and you know you can get a bunch of Eevees this way to fill out that as well. So yeah, I thought that was a nice little feature. There's 9 different mini games that you can play in there, including one called Magikarp Splash. I'm not sure what that does, but I hope it's similar to Magikarp Jump. Maybe it's sort of a precursor to that. That'd be kind of fun.
Blast from the past.
Oh, yeah. I think overall, like, despite not being like this full adventure, just kind of like reading through the features and the things that you can do in this game, I think it's a pretty, you know, substantial proposition for a Pokemon game on a home console. There's a pretty wide range of review scores. There were some complaints about the sound quality and also the scope. There are, of course, people who, like this isn't a full, like, Pokemon adventure. This is just a battle, you know, simulator.
Yeah, like GameSpot noted Hucksters. Uh-huh. Gave it a 5.7 out of 10.
I'm glad they're not around anymore.
You know, the true believers, Nintendo Power, 8.8 out of 10.
God, what weird scores, like 5.7, 8.8. I wonder what their criteria is. Like, what's the difference between a 5.7 and a 5.8?
I don't know. Sometimes it's like
impressed.
It could be the sort of thing where it's like they have 4 different things that they're rating it on, and they just add them all up.
Are they doing like a...
That could be.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they could have story, gameplay, graphics, or whatever. I don't know.
I do also remember the announcer when you're in the battle. It's like, it's super effective. Like, some guy, like, commenting on it like a sporting event, like it was,
and then someone had to record that
somebody
audio,
had to voice that.
Like,
yeah.
There's probably like sitting in the studio for 2 hours, like the producers there behind the mixer. Can you say it with more enthusiasm?
It's Nidoqueen. Just, you know, just
can you emphasize Queen just a little bit more?
Do you? I don't know if you have them in front of you, but can we talk sales numbers real quick?
Yeah, please.
You guys want to speculate on how many units this sold?
I know how many it sold.
You know how many it sold.
I don't know.
About 1,200. 3.97 million units. Yep. Do you know how much Red and Blue sold?
Hang on. I am going to... Wes, let's play closest to the pin, because I did not look this up.
I've got all three written down, the first three gens written down, so this is going to be great.
So Red, Blue combined, yes? Or Red,
yes,
Blue,
yeah,
separately?
Yeah, you count them each.
Red, Blue combined, I'm going to say 18 million.
I was saying like six something.
31 million.
Oh, we were even close.
Fucking million units. And granted, that's the power of the Game Boy versus the power of the N64. Gold and silver. I'll tell you it's less, but any guesses?
Around 20 million.
Very, very good. Very close to the pen.
22 million.
Oh, and Wes wins.
Oh, snap.
Oh, suck a dick.
No, literally, that's what you got to do. You got to suck a stick right now.
Oh, awesome.
No, and then if you were curious...
not on air.
About the Ruby and Sapphire combined. Do you care to guess? I'll just tell you.
No, I'll guess. I'll guess 16 million.
I will go with 18.
Oh, and John, on the pin, you both got to suck each other's dicks. This is great.
All right, but you have to stand on your head.
It's got to be ASMR style, so I'm going to get the microphone right in there. All right.
Can't we just read some slash fiction instead?
That was, man, remember when we did that? I gotta go find that and make you guys read it again.
I forget what it was, but it was like the following month after one particularly rough one, you're like, yeah, we're starting to lose listeners. Like, we need to stop doing this. We're losing listeners.
The metrics are always kind of fiddly.
You were saying that, but I don't think that's true. I think a lot of people probably tuned in for that.
Maybe.
Just fast forward to the end.
Should that be the new show? We just read slash fiction for a half hour?
I mean, but punitively, yes. I mean, so much could be enough to be punished.
I didn't think I'd go to bed at night. Yeah.
So, wait, what were we saying? Oh, you were talking about sales. Anything else about sales that you wanted to get to?
No, that's really it. I mean, again, this is also one of the best-selling N64 games, too. Mm-hmm. Or for the year, I should say. For the year, this was one of the best-selling games, and got a lot of accolades. And I forget what it was. It won some kind of Player's Choice Award for something or other, so.
That might have just been like a... It's possible that it just was Nintendo putting some marketing on the box.
Yeah.
They used to do that, I think, on the N64 as well as the GameCube. It was kind of like their best sellers label. They put a little yellow triangle in the corner and like, hey, Player's Choice. And there it is, right on Metroid Prime right there. So, and then they stopped that. They turned it into, on the Wii, they turned it into like a Nintendo Selects. Mm. I think Player's Choice is better. And now they just charge $60 for every game for all time.
There's also terminology associated with stakes. So I wonder what they're going with there. Like, you know, I don't know.
And then they made their Switch cards taste bad. This is all, like, related. This is coming together. Mm-hmm. So, this game is not available on any download service. You cannot play it except on a N64 cart. Used copies are generally going for about $40. For this thing. Plus you need an extra 10 or 15, sometimes high as $20 for a transfer pack. And then you need your functional Game Boy cart.
Man, I have all three.
Yeah, you do. You're sitting on a gold mine there, Wes.
But I don't have a functioning N64. It probably is. I think I'm probably just missing the power cord. I don't know. Something stupid like that.
I mean, we both got fully functional N64s. If all you're missing is a component or something, you're welcome to borrow one of ours.
Well, I can figure it out.
I'm offering John's. I realize I say I'm working on ours. It's like probably should get your okay with that first. But
the only game I would play would be Pokemon Stadium. Like I'm not playing like Ocarina of Time is a fantastic game. I loved it. It's a lot better than Stadium, but I'm not playing that on N64.
Gauntlet Legends.
Fuck that controller.
Yeah,
Gauntlet Legends. We can play that one again.
Oh my god!
One of myriad fighting games. God, they love fighting games.
But yeah, it's like Ocarina of Time. To your point, like there's a you know, a ton of other ways to play that game, including the very good remake on 3DS.
I'm still sad I never got it for my Wii. Like, I still have Majora's Mask on my Wii. But I don't have Ocarina.
You can probably still get it on Wii U if you had one of those.
I hope they do another remaster release of it at some point.
I'm sure in the infinity of time, they will eventually get around to re-releasing Ocarina of Time again, I don't think.
Yeah.
Maybe on Switch. We'll see.
It is.
We do love our base 5 anniversaries in North America. So, and I think this year is like the 35th anniversary of Zelda, which some people think is a big deal for some reason. I don't know that it really means anything. We'll see. So, that's all for games. We'll talk about some movies.
I have movies and a little bit of music to discuss.
Nice. Well. Where do you want to go first?
Why don't we knock out the music?
Music first?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to knock that out because...
So I got a good list of what you had at your local FYE, or I don't know where you were going in that day to buy music.
Maybe like a Peaches?
Yeah, your Peaches? Oh man, that's a blast from the past.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
what is Peaches?
Oh, precisely.
Yeah, Peaches was a record store here in Orlando, based by the name, obviously, record store / titty bar.
Oh, man.
No, I'm kidding. They had a really, really big kind of warehouse that was over on Colonial and McGuire for all of you Orlando natives, just outside of downtown in the Colonial Town area. And it was just great. It was huge. It was a big store. It was an independent record store. They had a Ticketmaster in there as well, so you could go buy your tickets there. Mm. And I just remember liking it a lot. I was very much spending money on physical media when I had it at the time, so I was going in and buying CDs all the time, not so much records. And this is also sort of like, this is the bottom of the barrel for record sales. This is when CDs were really pricing records out of the market, and now records are coming back.
Yeah, I mean, we even get to the point, like, we talked a few months back, like, when we just had, like, the launch of Napster in 1999. So we're really getting to the point where it's going to be the death knell for a lot of these retail outlets, because the market's just changing.
Yeah, and I think if you didn't do that, like, what, Best Buy was coming around? I remember Best Buy was kind of like a hot thing. In the early 2000s, because one opened up and they had like a big music section, and they also sold physical video games, they had PC games. Yep. I would go there buy my PC games, and I would go
fucking Circuit City.
Right, Circuit City was doing its thing. I'm trying to think of where else. What were the other? Like, I literally worked at a music store, so and this would be in like the mid 2000s is when I started working there. But there was a place called CD Warehouse, which was a secondhand store, so you could buy new or used, and you'd sell them there if you wanted. Loved working there, my god. But yeah, enough of that. Let's get into the music. Let's just talk about music. So February of 2000 had some really interesting stuff come out. I don't know if you guys know who Ghostface Killah is.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, he's a member of the Wu-Tang Clan. And the Wu-Tang Clan, if you think about it, I think 36 Chambers was their big breakthrough record, and that came out in like 94. So this is 6 years down the line, kind of well past it. If you don't know what Ghostface Killah's contribution to it all, he was the one that had kind of the nasalier voice that rhymed really, really fast, and all of his stuff was very non sequitur and abstract. So he would just kind of go and go and go and go, and it would take you multiple listens to really piece it all together.
Like Beck.
Yeah, actually, you know, that's a very, very good comparison.
Nice.
Beck's a little more like cool and smooth and funky.
This is like a faster.
Yeah, right. That's kind of his thing. And if you also like Wu-Tang for like the Shaolin style, you know, the old grindhouse samples and like crusty, like rusted out funk sound, you're not going to get that with this record. This is very much a record of the 2000s, like the early 2000s. The production sounds much more akin to something like Jay-Z, like big bombastic beats and jazz samples, and or like, you know, like not even jazz samples, just like brass samples, you know, like big trombone or horn leads and shit. I don't know. It's a good record. It was one of the best selling records of the month, which is why I'm leading with this. Not to say it's a particularly great record, but just getting that out of the way. Ghostface Killah, peak of his game, and. You know, it's like a lot of really talented people in and around Wu-Tang, so cool that he did his thing. Also, not his debut either. This, I think, is like his third album. He released a bunch of music. A band called Superchunk, they had a single come out, and this was from an album that was released like 6 months prior, but I think in their mind they were like, how is this not a huge, successful smash hit, called 1,000 Pounds. A song really you guys probably never heard of, but it's like an indie rock jam. You would hear it on college radio and the like. And I think if you just sat down and gave it a listen, you'd be like, man, this could have been a really big hit. It makes me think of like Modest Mouse's Float On. Like, would have really thought that would have been a hit, that Modest Mouse would produce the hit of the summer.
Yeah.
But then you heard
Float On?
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy Float On, but I mean,
yeah.
I'm always like, maybe we'll Float On. All right.
Yeah.
And hey, what's the rest of it? Keep going.
He hit his car into a cop car.
Yeah.
You know, that was
funny. Oh, that's a different song. that is the same song. That is the same song. I think it's something else.
Yeah, it's like a big jam. If you heard the track, maybe you would like it. 1,000 Pounds by Superchunk. Yola Tango, they are like an indie rock band. They released their probably most commercially and critically successful album called, it's got a long title, but it's like And Then Nothing. I personally don't like this band that much. I've never been able to get into these guys. They are like super like early Modest Mouse's like sad downer sleepy music. These guys have like perfected it.
Yeah, not interested in that then.
Yeah, yeah. This band does not come at you with hooks or big singles or like anything resembling energy. I think that's what people that really, and again, people like this band, I think that's what people do like about this, is that it is very good headphone music. If you're the type that wants to like kind of sit there and like listen to this earthy organic production and really get into it, there's probably something here to enjoy. For me though, I would go bands that are of their ilk would be like Pavement and Guided by Voices, and those bands know how to make catchy songs and deliver it in this sort of non non-fascist conformist rock and roll whatever shit. So so that's that. And again, I didn't like Yo La Tango at the time. I don't like them now, but I've certainly in the past 20 years listened to multiple of their albums at different points just to check in and make sure I still don't like them. Because I keep thinking they're going to get me at some point. Maybe I'll hit, maybe when I'm 50, I'll find something enjoyable about Yo La Tango.
Kind of like the reason I play first-person shooters. Right. Yeah. Do I still hate this? Yeah, I sure do.
It's still a terrible experience.
Do I still hate this fighting game? Yeah, I still do.
Am I still bad at Street Fighter? Yep, sure am.
Okay, now for a record that was fucking huge for me as a kid. I love this record. It's the band called Kid Dynamite. They're from Philadelphia. They released their second album called Shorter, Faster, Louder. And Kid Dynamite, I don't want to ramble about this band, but they are just so fucking good. They're a punk band. They're a punk band that does like pop punk with youth crew hardcore. When I was a kid, I was super into youth crew hardcore. It's like this very positive scene for kids who like don't necessarily fit in with all the other sounds, but also like want something heavy and hard. It's usually like big anthemic sing-along songs. Like you go to a concert and there's just a mandatory a pit is going all the time. Really, really fun. And this band, Kid Dynamite, has this ethos about them, which was, again, centered in the positive youth crew hardcore scene, which is that, you know, it's a community, it's like family. But then also, just getting you with banger after banger, man. These tracks, like, they probably released, I think their first album was 22 songs, and it clocks in at, like, 25 minutes. So, they're really short blast hits of music. And with this record, they kind of repeat the same thing. They kind of just do it even better. The production's a little stronger. They bring in this other band, which I was so obsessed with at the time, called F Minus. And F Minus is more of like a punk band, but they have all four band members sing, and it's two men and two women. So you have the main guy singing. You have this guy, Dan Yemen, who's the bassist and the backup vocalist. And then you've got four fucking people from F Minus, six different voices to do a minute and 20-second track. Like, it's just great. When you hear everyone all together at the same time, it's just, it's joyous. And think about, what would you compare this to? It's kind of like, imagine the, like, Ramones. Kind of like how, you know, the Ramones sort of like, we're going to take pop music, but we're just going to play it real fast, real sharp, mm-hmm. real intense. They're doing the same thing. Just all of these big anthemic choruses. Like, I go back and listen to this album, and it's a rush. It just makes me want to fucking run through a brick wall. I love Kid Dynamite so much.
That's why there's so many holes in your walls.
Yeah, that's exactly why. I mean, and well, you know, and the little glory hole business I run on the side. You know?
Oh, well, I mean,
there's money in getting your dick licked. You know, I'll tell you that much. Wait, where are we? Okay, moving on. A band I did not listen to at the time, but one that I loved listening to now is this group called Bloodbath. They released the EP called Breeding Death. This is...
They sound like a great band.
This is... So it's death metal, and it's Swedish death metal, which makes it even better. Real quick hit on that, by the way. If you're listening to old school death metal, it comes from three different places. In the late 80s, it came from three different places, which was England, Sweden, and Tampa, Florida. I kid you not. Tampa had a huge death metal scene that was really influential. But this band Bloodbath, so again, we're like 10 years after death metal is an established sound, and you've got a bunch of different guys from these Swedish death metal bands making a little bit of a super group. So they're all coming together, and their approach for this, and the Swedish sound in general, is one that's very technical. The musicianship is very strong, but also very, very punishing. Very fast, guttural vocals. Like, really just a great record to listen to if you're a fan of death metal, and don't want something that sounds like Cannibal Corpse. If you want something that sounds a little more organized and polished, while still being heavy as fuck. Bloodbath, Breeding Death. Got you covered. 13 minutes. Three songs. Worth it. I'll keep going. I need to speed this up.
Breeding Death in a Bloodbath is totally worth it.
Yeah.
Only for 13 minutes, though.
Yeah. After that, it gets a little stale.
Bloodbath literally... They released a new album last year, and it was a fucking great record. They release records a lot. This band's pretty prolific, but this is when they just got started. Again, I think these guys... I think one of the dudes is in this band called Opeth, which is much more of a melodic death metal band that people sort of like... I don't like it, but some people are super into it. I think it's a little too safe, but that's just me. Next record, another one. This was a rager. I know. I fucking went to I went to Best Buy and got the CD of this. Millen Collins, Pennybridge Pioneers, a classic of the Epitaph pop punk sound. These guys are also, by the way, from Sweden. You wouldn't really hear it if you listened to it. Just tons and tons of catchy songs, really bouncy pop punk. They had that song No Cigar on the Tony Hawk Pro Skater soundtrack. So a lot of people would probably just instantly hear that song and recognize this band. I love it. Really good production. Another album. Again, this was a really great month for music. Mindless Self-Indulgence. Do you guys know who that is by any chance?
No. Nope.
They are a weird fucking band. They are kind of like another edge. They're like an edgelord band, I guess you would call them. You know, they're like kind of that edgy at the time for kids that think suicide's cool. You know?
Oh my God.
So, right? They're, it's industrial music. It's punk music. They use a lot of drum and bass with just like out there pop elements in their music. The album, it was called Frankenstein Girls Seem Strangely Sexy, and if the cover art is just like a bunch of patched together, like it's drawing, it's a cartoon, but it's a bunch of like patched together cute looking scene babes that were like sewn together. But yeah, it's 30 tracks long and it clocks in at 54 minutes. Again, like literally one of the songs is just called Faggot, and the chorus is them saying nope. Faggot. The singer is super flamboyant, by the way. He is gay, so it's sort of like they're in on it.
He's reappropriating. He's taking it back.
So it's appropriate now?
Right.
Like it's fine?
I guess. I don't know. But
I mean, you might be able to get away with that in 2021. Like if you are identifying as like a homosexual. Like
they took the word queer back.
Yeah, so sure.
Queer is now like an inclusive term. It's positive. It's a term of positivity when once it was probably considered a jeer or an insult.
Are you allowed to use it if you're not?
I think if you're like identifying...
Don't like point at someone and say queer. That is obviously offensive. But if you're like, oh yeah, you know, like they are queer, that's not necessarily...
I think if you're like identifying a group of people who don't like identify as heteronormative, then I think probably... it'd be okay. But yeah, if you're like if you see like two dudes making out in the bed, you're like, hey, you queers. No. Wow.
John, a man of the 21st century, really nailing it.
Is gay allowed nowadays? I thought we kind of lost gay.
Yeah,
well, if you're using it in the pejorative sense, yeah, like
that's a little gay, like that's a no-no, but if you're like, well, he's gay, like it's...
Right, like you, like if someone identifies as homosexual, like yes, he's gay. Or, but if like someone is like you see someone on the sidewalk playing with Pogs, you're like, what are you, gay? Are those Pogs?
Yeah, don't be gay. Come on, yeah. Let's go inside.
Right. That okay. No, you shouldn't do that.
John, you're Pontius Pilate right now. I want a thumbs up or a thumbs down on the following expressions. Pillow biter.
I don't know that one actually.
Butt pirate.
Thumbs down.
Okay. That's the only two I had.
Spoon face.
Spoon face.
I don't know that one.
Yeah.
Apple picker.
Any language. Let's cover the mic.
I don't know that one either.
No, they're made up ones that Tosh Boyle did on an episode. He's like, are these racist or not? And he's just saying things.
Oh, okay. Let me just like...
Spoon face, apple picker. I mean, it means nothing. It sounds bad.
Yeah. All right. So, again, this band is edgy as fuck. All their tracks are like this. They just do and say weird things. It's very frenetic. Again, it is a lot of drum and bass and industrial punk with just over-the-top stuff. Literally, in this year, they were opening for Rammstein and ICP on separate tours. Like, it makes perfect sense that they would be in association with both German industrial Rammstein and then a clown hip-hop group, Insane Clown Posse. Like, and I'm sure they were great. They made perfect sense with both bands. They're weird. All right, I'll keep going. Hot Snakes. Hot Snakes released Automatic Midnight. If you don't know who that is, it's John Reese, who is in Rocket from the Crypt, and Rick Froberg from Drive Like Jehu. And that is sort of like a weird surf punk band, and then also kind of a weird angular punk band. And their sounds together just couldn't be more perfect. Like, these are two guys, it's like when you have a friend and you're like, wait, I think you and this guy would make really good friends, and they meet each other, and then they're just like the best friends ever, and they don't need you anymore. You know, that's what probably happened when whoever it was that knew both these guys told them to meet each other. That's kind of a weird example. But it is a great, great record. Again, if you like that kind of warble-laden guitar rock that's got a lot of punk sound that's really snotty and in your face and really cool. You kind of at the same time feel like you're at a beach, but it's not rock, it's not surf rock. Hot Snakes is great, and they've released like a ton of records. They've released like probably 4 or 5 LPs. A big hit single came off of this record, but Three Doors Down released The Better Life, which was, they were the ones that had that song Kryptonite.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
That one charted for a while.
I think that's like the only song that was a hit by them, right?
They had, because I looked them up on Spotify, they have another hit song that's out there. Oh. I forget what the title. Yeah, I forget what the title is, but I mean, hey, this song's got like 80 million listens. So yeah, it's like,
yeah, it's, I mean, I like the song.
And you know, they wrote that when they were, the singer of the band wrote it, I believe I've read that correctly, and he wrote it when he was in like, what do you call that? That class where you don't have to do anything in high school.
Study hall?
Study hall. He wrote it in like study hall when he was like 16.
All right.
So the guy made his band rich by writing that one song. And you know what? Like, I went back and listened to it. It's a catchy song. It's well produced. There's nothing really wrong with it lyrically or anything. I think you can't say it's the cheesiest shit ever. I mean, it's
not bad for a 16-year-old.
Yeah. You know? And they toured really hard. Like, they're one of those bands that tours and they'll play 200 shows a year. So they're still going at it. They released a record just a few years ago. So credit to them. You know,
yeah, all right.
Could make fun of them if you wanted, I guess. But I don't see the point. Getting there. Kid Koala. Kid Koala is a turntablist. He's a DJ, but he doesn't make hip-hop. He makes these sort of sound collages that are kind of weird and, like, I don't know what you... There's probably a word for it. I can't think of it, but... it's just interesting to listen to, I guess. It's like, now there's this big trend with lo-fi beats. But it feels like it's a Kindred Spirit, but it sounds nothing like... It's not chill music, really. It's more like he's creating these soundscapes using weirdo records he's found from the 50s and then mixing in, again, jazz records, funk records, all kinds of stuff. Like they used to make these records that would be stereophonic test tracks. And they would just be designed to like help you center your speakers, and it would literally be like two people playing a ping pong game or something.
Okay.
So you know, again, this is probably like I'm imagining this was like a dorm room pothead classic, right? Like if you were able to get marijuana in the year 2000, you would probably love this record. That said, I went back and tried to listen to it, and I just wasn't really feeling it. But it's okay. Appleseed Cast. Three more to go. Appleseed Cast. They are a band that I had a whole big thing I was going to talk about with emo, and I'll spare it because we've got stuff to say. But like in the big charting of emo, there's like,
is really that allowed now? Is that kosher?
What emo? Yeah, I'm just emo. I think it's fine. I think it's okay.
The emo community would be alright with me.
Again, it's like, are you just saying, oh, emo, or are you pointing a finger and saying it? If you're pointing a finger and saying anything, it's probably bad.
But anyway. The thing you have to think about is in the sort of like social structure that's been...
I was just making a joke. I understand.
Shut up and listen.
He says as he points at you. Holy shit.
I'm going to mansplain to you right now.
You mansplain to a man?
Oh yeah, of course you can. Oh, it's okay. Not about the audience, it's about the action.
Thank you for mansplaining that to me. All right. You dirtbag.
So there's sort of three waves that have occurred in the world of emo. Emo is a sound that's been around since the late 80s as well. And it's a sound that got popular in the Midwest, and it's actually very sweet music. If you would listen to the original emo bands that were out there, like Promise Ring or American Football, you would be like, wow, this is not what I thought emo was supposed to be. It's actually really delicate music with intricate guitar work, very pleasant atmospheric drumming, like gorgeously warm, smooth bass lines kind of everywhere. Like,
it is the hair over the one eye just screaming at the world.
That's what it became in the mid-2000s, right? That whole scene came along, and you've got groups like My Chemical Romance was hugely successful doing that sound. And again, I'm not trying to say any of that's bad. I kind of enjoyed some of it, too. But the movement got totally co-opted and shifted into another sound entirely. And now we're so far removed from that being popular that there is what is called the Midwest Emo Revival.
Oh,
which, God. Again, goes back to that. And I love this sound.
Sounds like a cult.
I can't get enough of it. But it goes back to those old bands and tries to emulate more of that original sound of it, more so than the, you know, pop punk's songs, pop punk with big breakdowns and songs about killing your girlfriend. Tries to avoid that kind of shit.
Yeah, you get to, like, Dashboard Confessional and Taking Back Sunday, yeah, kind of stuff.
Exactly. So Appleseed Cast, they were like one of the last bands of the old guard. Over the course of about 4 years, they're going to release three of the best albums in this sound, and it starts with this album, Mar Vitalis. I actually saw this band too. Like, I saw this band probably like 2006 or 7, play live, and oh my god, I was blown away. I love these guys so much. Really beautiful music. Very sad. Very American, if that makes sense. I don't know. They sort of say like nostalgia is like, you know, nostalgia is like a thing where you feel like, so you're thinking about something from the past and you like it, but the truest nostalgia is knowing that like that is gone. It's gone forever. You're never going to have it back, and all you have is your memory of it. So when I go back and listen to any of these old emo bands, it just instantly puts me back in a place and time where, like we always say, we had everything figured out. Life was sweet and love was real and everything was everything. You know, things were good. So going back and listening to Appleseed Cast,
the world was the world, and nothing could change it. Nothing could disrupt our genuine feelings of security and progress.
The shining city atop the hill, right? Mm-hmm. That hadn't been, you know.
We were never going to die.
Our capital was not on fire.
Indeed, it was not.
All right, enough of that. The Oasis released an album called Standing on the Shoulder of Giants, and my buddy Patrick literally wrote me like a 2-page
dissertation
of it.
An essay.
And I think maybe at some point we'll do our own little thing about that, and maybe we could just tack it onto our feed if anyone
Send me an audio file. I'll post anything. Except West reading / fiction.
Yeah, we'll tack that on.
Save that in your own save special file.
Yep. Two more albums and I'm almost done. Artful Dodger released a compilation called Rewind, The Sound of UK Garage. UK Garage is sort of like their dance music of the mid-90s. It was very, very popular over there. Nowadays, 2020 me loves the shit out of Garage. I think it's a great sound. But if you're from the UK, it's sort of like, I don't know, it would be like saying, you know, like, oh, people should like go listen to Britney Spears or something. Like, I'm sure that the sound was so prolific over there that all of the big pop records incorporated what is the garage beat, which kind of distinguishes itself from traditional house music. I love that Artful Dodger released a bunch of big singles back in the day too, so having him be the guy that organized this like 2-hour long thing was absolutely great. Again, just cool that came out. Again, me in 2000 wouldn't give a fuck about it, but now I loved listening to it. Lastly, I got Shakira's MTV Unplugged.
Right? Oh,
yeah. So this was her fourth album, technically, but this is also all in Spanish language. So before she had her big hit record, which was Laundry Service? I think it was called Laundry Service. But before that album came out, and all the tracks, or I think most of the tracks at least, were in English. All her big hit singles here have been in English. This was her last recording, still mainly driving this record towards her audience in South America. She's from Colombia. Or towards the Spanish language audience that is, you know, there's more Spanish people, there's Spanish speaking people in the Americas than there are English speaking people, so... Big deal.
I mean, even just in the United States, it was the second largest Spanish-speaking country in the world.
Yeah, hey, there you go, right? So it kind of makes sense that she's a big breakthrough artist, and, you know, she's still, like, a top 50 artist on Spotify. Like, she's still fucking going. 20 years later, like, of all of these bands, she's still fucking crushing it. She's as big now as she's ever been. And it's really, really... I kind of am reminded of how interesting the MTV Unplugged format was, because... you would get all of these bands doing these stripped-down productions of their albums. And, you know, hers is really interesting. Again, like, because it's from three albums where she never really had a big single that charted yet. So it's none of her... it's all in Spanish language. So really, you're just getting these kind of acoustic performances with her singing in Spanish in a very raw way. Like, her voice... you kind of got to listen to it for her voice, because sometimes you're like, you got to be fucking kidding me that you're singing like this right now. because it's so like outside of the bounds of what is normally like considered pop, you know, acceptable pop singing. Like, she like has this voice that is like half of it her is sort of like doing like operatic singing. It's just that kind of like big warbly stuff that she does, and the other half she sounds like she's a fucking like witch doing some kind of incantation and does them both together and then just doesn't mind doing them back and forth within the same breath. Like,
see, what you don't know is that she actually is doing an incantation and yeah. somebody just died.
Yeah, you know, you say that. I was at my desk listening to the album and then everything kind of just started to levitate a few inches off the table. I was wondering what that was about. It's my girl Shakira. So yeah, that is like a quick hit of all of the music that came out in February of 2000. Was that a quick hit? That was probably not a quick hit.
There is one more that I don't have too much to say about it. I just want to like mention that it existed. Smashing Pumpkins, Machina.
Yes, that did come out. I didn't even need to mention that one. Was it a single or was that all?
No, it was like their fifth studio album. It wasn't great. Okay. And I really like Smashing Pumpkins, but at this point in their sort of musical career, they've like become like just characters of themselves. They're so far up their own asses. Like, especially like Billy Corgan, the lead singer. He eventually gets to this point where, and he's still there, where no one is a bigger fan of him than him.
Yeah.
And yet, like, it was very much like this very exaggerated tone, trying to go, trying to be a little too gothic, maybe. And it just kind of, like, misses the mark from a lot of the things that made a lot of the previous albums so successful. There's a sort of like you were saying, like there's a like this Americana nostalgia, but that's also very subversive in Smashing Pumpkins music to that point. And I'm not gonna not particularly great.
Does he at least give you that kind of like screechy voice that sounds like cats fucking?
Yeah, but that takes it to another level.
Okay,
it's not.
Good. And again, this is the I'm assuming was this. After Melancholy and Infinite Sadness came out, like after all of their big hits, like
yeah,
okay,
yeah, I think this might have been their last studio album for quite some time. Mm. I think it wasn't until like the mid-2000s that they finally came out with another one.
Right.
Well, yeah, there's as you would expect with a big personality like his, and there's a lot of tumultuous times.
That William Corgan.
Yep. So movies,
man.
Just like the music, there is this smorgasbord films that, you know, they're not all particularly great, but they're at least interesting.
I managed to watch five of them.
I have watched, within the past couple of days, I've watched three of them.
Ooh.
And there's one more that I'm very familiar with, even though I haven't watched it recently.
Yeah.
And how many movies altogether are there?
Six.
Hundreds of thousands of films.
Oh, yeah, so probably millions to this point.
Yeah, that's tons. I had no idea.
There are either millions or there are six.
Did you know that they made like four Toy Stories?
Holy shit.
Yeah.
They didn't get everything out by the second one?
No.
It just gets darker and darker as it progresses as well. I mean.
Well, yeah, like, I think Little Nightmares 2 is canonical.
I'm having such a good time with that game.
Yeah.
It came out today at time of recording.
We digress.
It's so fucking fun.
Yeah, Mika kept putting off going to bed and making excuses to come out and watch it.
Because she wanted to watch, yeah. I don't know, where do you guys want to start?
I don't know all the movies off my head. I know two of them, but
I got The Beach, Pitch Black, Reindeer Games, Whole Nine Yards, and Scream 3.
Okay. I'm going to go, I'll start with Boiler Room then, since you don't have a list. I have not been able to watch it. I've only seen it like once. It stars Giovanna Ribisi, also has Vin Diesel in there for a little bit. It's kind of like this, Wall Street movie, but I think it's, again, a lot like Wall Street movies you've seen before. Things come crashing down at the end and they realize like the greed is not good. I don't remember too much about the sort of like arc of the story, but that was kind of like the general point it was trying to make. Yeah. Nothing really particularly memorable about this one, but when I did see it years and years ago, I remember thinking it was okay.
Yeah. This is one that was even available for me to stream.
Oh yeah, where?
My buddy's Plex account. Okay. He likes to upload movies to it. He already had it there for some reason. I didn't even watch it. Again, there was other movies that I was like, I just kept being like, gosh, I'd rather watch this, or I'd rather watch this, or, you know, and just kind
of... I'm not a fan of romantic comedies,
but I would like to see Vin Diesel in one. Just something way off of what he normally does. Let's just see him do something other than...
I'm trying to think one on the top of my head. I don't
action
know.
Movie. Like, in Boiler Room, that's not, like, an action movie or anything. No. Like, so what's Vin Diesel doing in it?
Right. He's just kind of, like, you have this, like, perception of him as this sort of meathead.
Yeah, exactly. So I would love to see him do something completely, like, what the fuck is he doing in this
thing?
What if
he was a talking tree?
He could do that. He could also be a talking robot.
Oh, that's good, too. Mm-hmm.
Who do you think would win in a fight, the Iron Giant or Groot?
But at the same time... Both those movies, he literally has, like, Groot, he literally has one line, I am Groot. Yeah. And Iron Giant, he says, like, what, two sentences in the whole movie?
He does say that he's Superman at the end of it, right before he immolates.
So, I mean, in movies where he actually, where he's not just beating people up, he has, like, one line.
Fast and the Furious, yes. Earlier Fast and the Furious films, he was required to talk.
So why don't we just move over to Pitch Black, the other Vin Diesel vehicle?
Yeah, he had two films out this month. He was a busy man.
Busiest actor in Hollywood for the month of February in 2020.
Yeah. I think Pitch Black is fun. It's not necessarily a good movie, but it's fun.
I agree with your sentiment. I don't think it's particularly good. It's very watchable. Yeah. Like, I probably had the best time watching Pitch Black, which is a very bright movie. As opposed to, like, the other things that I watched from this list. I think that Pitch Black does a good job of drawing you at least into the environment. Like, it does a good job drawing you into the world. But then, like, the narrative and the characterization is all very flat.
Well, I sent you my notes. I don't know if you even had a chance to read them before. Yeah, like, that was something I said, like, as a positive about it, was that you could tell that they made this with a small budget, but they got every dollar invested out of it. They do a lot of really interesting stuff, especially with lens filters to change the colors to really make it feel otherworldly, when you can tell they probably just drove
100
miles east of LA into the desert and just filmed it there.
The colorization is very important. A little bit like just out of film school sort of stylization to it. Like, anytime there's a shift in the narrative, you're going to see a different sort of color filter over the lens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would think, honestly, my biggest complaint was just that... you know, it's a premise we've seen before, which, you know, that's fine. You can tell in a movie like this. It's essentially the whole marooned group of misfits on an island. They're trying to get off of it.
But aliens.
Yeah. Well, and you don't even really...
That's the last. What is it, like, probably 60% of the way into the movie, then you get the aliens.
Yeah.
Right. And even then, they are aliens, they're just dumb animals in their environment doing what they do. It would be like if we just threw you into the swamp and there's alligators. It's like, the alligators aren't tacticianers that are doing anything special. They're just hungry animals that will eat you. Yeah. And that's what the aliens are in this world. They don't really do much to really be all that menacing or creepy. Like, these aren't even raptors opening doors. Like, this is just, like, you got these scary looking things on this alien planet that, gosh, I wish you wouldn't have landed on.
Yeah, I think that was one of the weaker points about the movie. Not only like the plot in general, but that sort of antagonist role. Because, you know, you have Vin Diesel. It's not even his movie. Like, the character Riddick. Like, he's not a
he's
character.
He's just one of the people.
Right. He's not really going through any sort of journey. It's the captain. Fry is her name.
Yeah.
Philip J. Fry.
Better's there in the crew as well.
She's the one who has that sort of arc of the character, who goes from someone who's just willing to dump the passengers and let everyone die to the point where, you know, by the end, she's willing to go through self-sacrifice to save everyone who's still alive.
That's really generous read of her character. I think she's boring.
It is very generous. I don't think they do anything to earn that arc. But that is the technical thing that happens within the script.
That's what I also read. I was like, he didn't have a good foil. Like, he's a silent anti-hero, and he's either surrounded by do-gooders or other... His one big villain that is the guy that... The bounty hunter that...
Johns,
...arrested him, who is himself a rather silent anti-hero as well.
And they don't do anything with that character to make it seem like he's on Riddick's level. Like, Riddick is definitely, like, put on this pedestal. Like, look at this motherfucker who is just able to work his way, or fight his way out of any situation. And this guy over here in the baseball cap is the guy you're supposed to believe just has, like, him under his thumb. And, like, don't worry, I have this Riddick guy under control. No. Yeah. They're not equals.
Right. Yeah, and I don't know about you, man. Like, Keith David is a great actor. He is the least convincing imam. Like, I'm sorry. I just did not for half of a second buy him as that character. But it's cool that he's there.
I don't know. I was willing to roll with him in that character. But he's another one of character. He doesn't really, like, have a function rather other than to, like, remind everyone of sort of, like, some sort of moral compass. Like, it's good.
That's a good point. Yeah, he is there. He actually does deliver something outside of exposition.
Yeah.
You know, he actually kind of gives you some sort of moral or ethical quandary about what these characters find themselves
in. Speaking of which, I think Netflix sent me the director's cut, and I don't remember there being any voiceover in the original cut, and there's not much voiceover, but right at the beginning when the ship is crashing, you get some voiceover from Vin Diesel.
I'm fairly certain my version had that as well.
And it's just such a strange, like, such a strange amount of exposition where, you know, they could just show you, that they are showing you the things. He's narrating the things as they're happening. Like,
oh God, what movie? What's the Harrison Ford movie? What's the
Blade Runner.
Yeah, what is this, Blade Runner?
It did remind me of Blade Runner where, like, you don't need this narration and it would probably be better if it wasn't there.
This is literally one of three movies we'll be talking about from this month that has narration from the main character.
Yep.
That I saw. And that's 60% of the movies I saw. But yeah, that's it. Oh, and the brunette woman that's in it that sadly...
Claudia Black?
...has an untimely demise. Claudia Black, she's great. Mm. She's does tons and tons of sci-fi prop... like
Farscape.
Farscape especially. I love Farscape. I think that one doesn't really get its due. It's very much like... It is kind of like Muppets. Like, think of what the Orville tries to do. While Orville is very much Seth MacFarlane's style of comedy... it is very much like a fun science fiction romp. So I like Farscape a lot. And she's just been in tons of different science fiction vehicles, especially things like, I think she was in Babylon 5 too. But she's also a very famous video game voice actress.
Oh yeah?
So she's got probably 50 credits for video game voice acting.
Hmm.
And she's got a great voice too. She has that kind of like, kind of proper yet feminine British thing going on.
I think she's Australian.
Australian thing going on. I don't know. She's pretty. I just like looking at her face.
I think we're
coming for tits.
Draw smiley faces on them. Okay. So Des is gonna wake up with some weird drawings. So I don't know if I have too much. I think we're moving on from Pitch Black here. Yeah, I just kind of wrap up in the movie. Like, I had a good time watching it. It is very flawed. I think it was. The way I envision it, someone had an idea for a movie and they tried to wrap a plot around that.
Yeah.
Well, this is a scene where they have to have light in order to scare away animals to run through the black.
Yeah.
Alright, what story do we do with this?
And then pitch. Baseballs.
They're like, yeah, how can we work cricket into this?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was a premise in search of a movie.
Well, it's also the first of three films. This is a series that...
It Vin became Diesel, a series for some reason.
It's all following the Riddick guy, which...
Well, technically, the next... So, I actually looked it up. The second movie in the series does bring back Keith David. And it also has an adult version of the girl in it.
Yes.
Jack, right?
Yes. Yeah, she has some kind of... You remember that?
I just looked up the casting.
Gotcha.
I was like, that's the name of the character.
Yeah, so... she survives and then finds herself in a very similar scenario, it seems like, to what the dead girl from this movie goes through.
Okay.
So, anyway.
No, you find Jack in the second one in a prison on a planet where the sun is so hot it will literally...
You better break it down, Wes. Break down the Riddick franchise.
You'll burst into flames.
Actually.
What? Actually. He finds her in a prison.
Oh my God.
He finds her in a prison, and then they have to run across the planet and outrun the sun, and you see it coming, and blah, blah, blah. And then he takes over the bad guy clan from after killing a guy.
I mean, I find this Riddick character to be just thoroughly uninteresting. I don't know why he is the main point. Like, he's a character... he's not going to be a different dude at the beginning than he is at the end.
No.
He's already achieved self-actualization. Why is he watchable?
The end of the third one, he is the exact same character as the beginning of Pitch Black.
Of course he is.
There's no difference in the character at all.
Whoever is writing this character loves this character and just wants to see him do cool shit. You're
perfect as you are. Go out and play.
Like, feeling is probably Vin Diesel.
he's the navigating.
Like, this is my John McClane. He's going to be the same guy all the time.
All right, other movies. Yeah. We should get to other movies.
Yeah, sounds like I'm kind of a pass on this one.
I think it's okay?
You think you could actually get
I think it's an entertaining watch.
It's fine for what it is. It's fine. Yeah. Whatever. It's...
All right, what next? You want me to do one that you haven't seen or one that...
Where's this beach?
The beach?
Where's the beach? Tell me about the beach.
I've seen this movie like three times now. I don't know what it is yet.
So it's Danny Boyle made it. Danny Boyle is a British director. And I think that... I'll start with the best thing I can say about him is that Danny Boyle never... repeats styles of films. He is the opposite of a genre director. Think about like who's the guy that made the Transformer movie? Michael Bay. Michael Bay, if you see that his name on a billboard, you know it's an action movie.
It's gonna be some kind of slow action thing with excessive explosives.
Right.
That just don't make sense.
Even someone like a Tony Scott, may he rest in peace.
Yeah. Tony Scott, again, kind of sticks to action adventure kind of films. He could do a thing like Top Gun, but he also could do a thing like True Romance.
Did you hear the guy from Knives Out died?
Which one?
The old man.
Christopher Plummer?
Yeah.
Yes.
He died.
Yes, he did. He was very old. He had a good run. He made some really good movies.
Did he mauled to death? How did he die?
Parachuting.
Oh, poor fella.
I told him not to. I told him it was going to get him one of these days. No, but anyway. So yeah,
wow.
Danny Boyle. Some movies that he's done. If you think about it, he did Trainspotting. He did
28 Days Later.
28 Days Later. Sunshine is a science fiction film. Yep. He won
Slumdog Millionaire.
A bunch of Oscars for Slumdog Millionaire. 127 Hours. He is just all over the place. It seems like genre doesn't mean anything to him. He just makes movies that are projects that he thinks are interesting. So The Beach, what it is it's based on a book, but it's sort of like this young, rudderless 20-something guy, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, went to Thailand, apparently not to have sex with underage children. Let's get that out of the way.
Which no one should do.
What happens when someone goes to Thailand.
We'll plant this flag in the ground. We are against pedophilia.
Right. And I'm glad
you said that before I made a joke.
Because it sounds like the big thing is that he just wants to get marijuana. Which, like, couldn't he have just gone to Holland where it's legal?
Well, I think, like, the sort of impetus for him being in Thailand is that, first of all, as a setting, like you're immediately a fish out of water. You're a stranger in a strange place. It's even more.
Oh, this movie starts with narration, by the way.
That's the ever recorded narration.
Is it Leonardo DiCaprio doing it?
Yes, Leonardo DiCaprio is doing this narration. There's this superstructure because he is narrating. You get the perspective that he is narrating from the end of the movie. So at the movie's at the biggest height of tension, the biggest moment of drama. Where you think Leonardo DiCaprio is going to die, you always have it in the back of your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's been narrating this whole time.
Yeah.
So, well, but it turns out he was a prisoner on the beach all along.
Yeah. Wait, what?
It's just like Lost.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. I see what you're referencing there now.
Yeah.
So
I was not referencing Lost, but...
But yeah, so this is supposed to be like he's on a journey of self-discovery or something, right? Or he wants to find some meaning in life. And essentially what he does is ends up running into a guy at a hostel who he then finds dead, but gives him a map to an island. He convinces this young couple that's also doing the same thing that are French to join him on this adventure. They go to the island, and they find out that half of the island is being run by a bunch of Thai people. Thai, I don't even know if you call them criminals or whatever, but they're growing marijuana on the island.
The only reason, like, you suspect they're criminals is because they are armed.
Yeah, they have...
And at the time, marijuana.
They have AK-40.
I don't know if marijuana has ever been illegal in Thailand.
That's the thing. All of the things. Like, again, I think that they made it way too soft, right? Like, the thing that they should be farming is, like, an illicit drug, like opium or cocaine or something.
Yeah, they're like a fentanyl lab.
But we wouldn't like these... I mean, we're already kind of don't like these people. But, Leo and his people, like, they're awful. But if they were doing hard drugs, we would certainly like them less. Mm. Like, he had the cast Trainspotting all on heroin.
No, I'll say at the time of 2000, I mean, that was, they're not.
And yeah, nowadays in America, like, marijuana just is not what it was in the 2000s, like, early 2000s.
No, early 2000s, I was like.
Very taboo thing. Now it's
a gateway drug.
Yeah, exactly.
You do marijuana, that means you're immediately doing heroin and crack next week.
One hit of the weed and you're
done.
You're shooting up heroin behind the dumpster at the pot.
Lock up your wives, lock up your daughters.
Yeah. But what he finds is that there's also this little commune of people that have basically gone away from the Puritan struggles of life and now live on the other half of this island, and they have this mutual agreement that they don't fuck with the drug people and the drug people don't fuck with them.
So long as no one else new comes to the island.
Bingo. So, of course, Leonardo DiCaprio's character has fucked the whole thing up by, one, having the map from the guy that died. Did I mention that he committed suicide? Actually, we shouldn't get too much into the plot of what this whole thing is. You can watch the movie if you want to know what the plot is, right?
Spoilers.
But basically, yeah, what you end up seeing is a bunch of people that are very selfish and self-indulgent, hedonistic, don't care about each other, use this idyllic lifestyle of living on an island to avoid the realities of their existence. When they see another suffer, they laugh about it. It's very much a Lord of the Flies kind of scenario. They kind of turn against each other.
Don't kill Piggy with a boulder.
Yeah.
Sorry. Spoilers for Lord of the Flies.
There's a statute of limitations. You're fine.
But yeah. I mean, so that's kind of what there's this wild scene that's sort of like he goes on. He gets exiled from this group for a terrible thing he did.
Right. So, right. He pretty much exposed them to more people coming to the island. So they're like, okay, well, you have to wait here on this cliff and make sure that no one else shows up.
Yeah.
And that just becomes his existence. And he has this psychotic break.
Yeah, well, he goes on what is essentially a vision quest that Danny Boyle literally said was filmed to look like Banjo-Kazooie. Because he's literally playing a video game. There is supposed to be some kind of commentary from Danny Boyle's perspective that video games are bad.
Mm.
Like, 3 or 4 times in the movie, they bring up video games.
Yeah, kind of like as this punchline, as like this cutting remark.
Yeah, as though one wastes their life in pursuit of video games, when he's literally filming all of these self-indulgent, awful people wasting away their lives in pursuit of an idealistic living while watching their friends die. You know? Again, all of the people just end up being so unlikable. Every conflict that Leonardo DiCaprio's character faces is literally of his own construction. Like, he gets the French couple to break up so he can start having sex with her. And then he hooks up with the woman that runs the island just because she says she wants to have sex. Like, he could have said no. Like,
well, there's, I think
she doesn't run the island.
Getting back to, like,
you know,
yeah, the sort of plot points of the movie. She does hold some sort of power over him because she knows that he has given away their location, and she's not going to sell him out if he goes and warms up the bed for her.
Right.
I think it was like the line of dialogue. So I mean, it's a pretty weak premise.
And then he lies to her about it too.
Right, and. In general, like, what is she going to do? Like, I don't see what, like, the big sort of exposure is going to be. Like, what would anyone have done if he was like, oh, shit, right, I doodled the map and gave it to this other dude. Sorry, if he shows up, we'll just kick him out.
Yeah. And then what ultimately happens is it leads to the death of 4 people who the drug people end up murdering these 4 people that he divulged the information to, right? And they, at the end of it, are very much like, we don't want to kill you people.
Right.
We didn't want to do that at all, but you made us do it because we have families to feed, and our marijuana operation is what funds that. Right? Like, so... So the
marijuana growers are the good guys?
Yeah. Well, just because these people are so bad.
Kinda.
They end up being more sympathetic.
By proximity, they're good guys.
These are horticulture enthusiasts were... They did kill 4 people who came to the island. And look, the first one they killed, one of them just got panicky. And then it's kind of escalated from there.
Itchy trigger finger.
So they probably would have preferred not to kill anybody. But, you know, their hands aren't clean. Well, but as far as people to root for, I think they're the most sympathetic group.
And the last one that gets shot is stopped by Leo. Leo's character is literally waiting on the ground and then scares her so she stops running and then gets shot. So
yeah.
If he had done nothing, there's a chance she could have gotten away and survived. But he literally contributed to her death. And by the way, there's like someone gets attacked by a shark. 2 people get attacked by sharks. One, rather than getting them off of the shore and getting him medical help, they just leave him in a tent and let him get gangrene and then die. Or well, to the point where I guess it's supposed to make us like Leo, that he's the one that does the mercy killing. Like, Yeah. There is just so much repugnant shit that happens with these characters that you just kind of hard to root for them.
Yeah.
And then it has this punchline ending where it's sort of like they're looking at a photograph of all of them and they're like, wasn't that great? Wasn't that great how there's now six people that died that didn't have to die? Right? And like, we totally
I think
broke each other emotionally.
I think like the movie is aware of that because you can see it through Leonardo DiCaprio's performance at the end. He's looking at the picture and at first like he's looking at it, it's like, oh my goodness, look at how much fun we're having there. And then you can see it like slowly melt off of his face where like, oh shit, right, all that other stuff that happened after we took that picture.
Yeah. And then the little top he was spinning starts to water. Yes. Now, I have a couple other points, I guess. The soundtrack is great. This is very much a 2000 soundtrack from Danny Boyle. It's got a lot of interesting British electronic music from the likes of Moby and Underworld. Really enjoyable. This movie made $150 million. This movie was fucking successful. Apparently, they had even started filming with Ewan McGregor as the main character.
Okay.
But they had the chance to get Leo. And apparently this was a big fallout. I read about it. There was a big fallout between Danny Boyle and Ewan McGregor. And of course, he and Ewan McGregor had worked on Danny Boyle's first three films together. So, like, that was his guy. And it was Danny Boyle's decision ditch Ewan McGregor to bring in Leo. Which, to his credit, was a good move because this movie probably made $100 million more than it would have.
Mm.
If not for the fact that they brought in, like, the American heartthrob fresh off of making the Titanic. So, like, Leo was, like, a big fucking deal. So that alone probably got a lot of butts in the seats.
When was the last time Leo made anything relevant?
He's constantly making relevant movies, man.
When was the last movie he was in with Scorsese?
Scorsese
directed.
He's a meme now. He's practically a fucking meme. No, he did, what was that, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood recently?
Yeah.
That.
Wolf of Wall Street, that was within the past 5 years.
Yeah. Inception was kind of a long time ago at this point.
Oh, God, I love Inception.
He gets around. Yeah, he still works his projects.
But, like, it was such an interesting career path that he ended up taking, like, fresh off the success of Titanic. He could have been the biggest movie star in the world for, and he was for a bit, but, like, the projects he chooses wasn't, like, sort of reprising that and maintaining that sort of image of the heartthrob, the leading man.
Also, to kind of prove his mettle, he's in What's Eating Gilbert Grape, where he portrays someone with disabilities. So
I think that was before Titanic, but you get the beach working Danny Boyle, and then he starts working with Martin Scorsese quite a bit in movies like the Aviator, The Departed was I think 2006. So you know he took that success that he had, and instead of like turning it into a vehicle for getting these massive paycheck projects, he's like, okay, well. Yeah. Let's do some interesting projects.
Let's visit, like, a guy like George Clooney's look is timeless. Like, he's aging exceptionally well. Leo is not the heartthrob he was back then. You look at him from, like, his Romeo and Juliet days, and you can see why the girlies are into that. He's a very, very, very handsome, pretty lady.
he's got a very youthful look, and I think that was like probably part of the appeal is like the youthfulness. And now that he is aging, like I think there was a meme about this. He is kind of turning into Jack Nicholson. Yeah. Christian Slater must be so jealous.
It's true. Gosh. Yeah, I think it's just that his face got a little cheeks got a little puffier or whatever. But I mean, he's still obviously a very handsome man. But like, yeah, he's not that guy that was gonna carry those kind of movies forever. Mm. So. It's good to see him, you know, maybe showcase like, that he's a genuinely good actor.
Maybe like a genie showed him what he was going to look like in the future. It's like, I better keep up this acting thing.
Knock this out.
I better be good at this. where do we want to go next? We did Pitch Black. We did A Boiler Room, The Beach, The Whole Nine Yards. Not a movie that I saw recently, but I have seen that one a bunch of times. That's a fun little almost noir-esque comedy.
Yeah. So it's directed by this guy, Jonathan Lynn, who made Clue and My Cousin Vinny, which really just tells me that this guy doesn't get in the way of the actors. He kind of just puts the actors out there and has them be interesting characters and tells a fun story. And that's what I think about this movie. It happens pretty much pitch perfect to his benefit, where you've got Matthew Perry and Bruce Willis, Rosanna Arquette, like kind of at the peak of their powers. And then you also have Amanda Peet, who kind of comes out of nowhere and is like kind of the best character in the whole movie, honestly. Everybody kind of gets the space to do their thing. There's some clever twists along the way. It's just genuinely funny.
I need to see this one again, because I always get this one and the sequel confused. The
whole tenure.
They're both badly named movies. Like, this movie has nothing to do with sports. It's a hitman comedy where Bruce Willis is this hitman sort of on the reform and trying to hide out in Canada. Matthew Perry recognizes him. They strike up this friendship. And then, like, there's this sort of cascading sort of events where some people come after Bruce Willis. Amanda Peet was this hit lady who was after Matthew Perry. Yeah. I don't even remember why. He just kind of like
wife,
this dude.
His wife hired her to be the assassin. But she ended up actually... Because Matthew Perry is genuinely likable. She ends up liking Matthew Perry just as a person.
He's kind of like this neurotic... almost like a Jesse Eisenberg sort of character. Like, Jesse Eisenberg would probably play that role.
I don't know why Matthew Perry's career didn't, like, take off after Friends and everything. Like, he did this.
He did. He made this.
He made this, but then, like,
they made it really after that.
And a sequel. He did this in a sequel.
It was really probably...
He was just done.
No, the cocaine. Probably the coke.
What, was it the cocaine?
It was probably the cocaine.
Oh, I didn't know he had the cocaine.
No, well, he also did... He did a movie with Selma... he did what we'll call 3 to Tango. Which was about a love triangle, which was a very successful film. He did, I can't even think of the title of it, but he did one with Salma Hayek in which he accidentally impregnates her, and the two of them had to figure things out, which is just, like, great. Like, okay, I get to have sex with Salma Hayek.
She tripped, and he just kind of flung it at her? Like, what? How did it happen on accident?
Isn't that how it works?
They hooked, I mean, they just, I forget the whole circumstances, but they were drunk and hooked up or something.
Oh, it was knocked up.
Yeah, they were
like,
basically, yeah.
Knocked up with Salma Hayek. Better movie in general.
But yeah, it's very much a fish out of water, because Matthew Perry gets to do his neurotic, sarcastic thing, and then Salma Hayek is Spanish. So... you get those two on that odd couple, but yeah, this is a genuinely funny movie. There's a lot of great gags and bits. Like, Matthew Perry is simultaneously good at physical comedy. There's a lot of really funny laugh out loud, like, just gags and gaffes he does. His delivery is on point too. Like, just the way that he constantly has that whole, like, Kafka-esque, I can't believe everyone is talking about this right now. Why are we all not insane? Where he sees himself as the voice of reason as hitmen are discussing, like, how they're going to, like, just go off a mob boss.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just like...
So, like, he's got, like, his foot still in reality. And he's like, this isn't how people should behave, everyone who is in this room with me right now.
Yeah. Bruce Willis, to his credit, Bruce Willis consistently has really good chemistry with his unassuming romantic leads. Like... Him and Amanda Peet have a really good thing going. Amanda Peet just kills it. She's fucking great in this movie, too.
Bruce Willis when he does comedy, when he's not playing a character who's not trying to be funny. Yeah. He's just kind of like, yeah, we're going to go kill these guys.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. He's he's Vin Diesel, but charming.
Yeah, charming Vin Diesel. There you go. See, he can do things outside of action. Not much.
That's all I got to say.
Can't stray far from it, but he can do it.
They made this movie for a sparse $30 million, and it made $100 million, so this was a successful movie, hence why they made a sequel. That's all I gotta say. I'm good, unless you got anything else.
Let's go over to Scream 3.
Yeah, so Scream 3 was probably my favorite of all of the movies, believe it or not.
Okay.
There's just a lot going on with this movie, man. This is absolutely wild. So it's literally all of the things I'm about to say are in one film, and somehow it all manages to be cohesive, but it's a comedy, it's a horror, it's a meta fourth wall breaking film, it's a psychological thriller, and it's a whodunit mystery. It's five different genres all just, like, thrown in a blender into this one film, and it all really works. It all kind of has its place and does its thing. So if you don't want to know the setup on why it's Scream 3... The first two events occur, of course. It's a bunch of teenagers getting together to watch a horror movie, and then there's these two psychopaths that are among their friend group that start killing everybody. They then go to college, right? And it ends up being... Oh, God, who was the killer in that? I'm trying to think of who it was.
I don't remember much about the sequel.
But they,
I don't know anything about the movies, but we're good.
Okay, but basically, they go to college. Another killer emerges and starts taking them out. And then that, of course, gets undone. And then the third one picks up where the events that happened to them in real life has now turned into a successful horror franchise. So you're watching a horror film about the making of horror films. And again, a killer...
About the thing that happened in it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, except in the movie Scream 3, they are making the movie Slay 3. So they're making the
Stab
movie...
Stab 3.
Yes, Stab 3.
Right.
So they've already made Stab 1 and 2. They've already made the movies based on the other two movies. They're in the process of making the movie that is unfolding in Scream 3.
God.
Yeah. And the result?
Now, this is them up their own ass. Like, this is...
it's good. So what ends up happening is you get this fun dual casting because you literally have these real-life people. Like, I mean, in the story, so you've got, like,
for the actual people, and then
Courtney Cox's character, she's like a real life person in this, and she now has Parker Posey playing her in the adaptation, who is herself another actress. So just her performance alone is like a Rubik's Cube, because you're watching her be some character trying to pretend to be this other girl while also being herself. Like, it's the most complex. Like, when her...
She's the dude playing the dude disguised as another dude.
Bingo. Perfect. And the two of them get to pal around for a lot of the movie, and, like, it's clear that Courtney Cox just fucking hates this woman.
They really have a fun dynamic, because...
They're a delight whenever they're on screen together. Yeah, Parker Posey just fucking crushes this movie. Yeah, the cast as well. So there's actually a cameo from Jay and Silent Bob in this.
Yeah, sure is.
Carrie Fisher's in it. They found a great way to bring back Jamie Kennedy. I don't know if you remember Jamie Kennedy's character. He was the one that was the horror movie aficionado from the first one that sort of describes the rules, like, you know, only virgins live, like, don't separate the group.
Yeah, he was the one kind of doing the fourth wall breaking.
Yeah.
To that point.
So literally, he filmed himself... Because he dies in the second movie, right?
Yeah.
He filmed himself saying what the third movie would be about before his death. So they even have this VHS that they plug in, and he sort of describes, like, again, just the way that he did in the first two, where he's, like, describing the rules of horror movies, and he's always right. He's correct about everything. And what he even says is going to happen.
Yeah, he still dies in the second one? Come on, man.
Yeah, he couldn't avoid it.
Yeah, he kind of explains what's going to happen, which is that the villain will seem superhuman. Which, if I can spoil that twist right now, the villain is actually the Neve Campbell's character, because it's the perspective of the killer. Like, she's the one that's superhuman and just cannot die. You really cannot fucking kill this woman, no matter how hard you try. and then there's a big revelation that changes everything we know about the story. That's what happens in the third movie. And that revelation is the fact that Neve Campbell had a brother the whole time. And that brother ends up being the killer.
I think that was probably, like, the weakest plot, because they kind of try to, like, have this moment of exposition. Like, it was, like, the villain, the actual person committing murders in Scream 3 is the director of Stab 3.
Right.
And he kind of, like, has this moment of exposition, like, well, I manipulated those two dudes in the first movie into committing those murders, and I was behind the scenes manipulating things in Scream 2 Okay, sure.
It is convoluted, and yeah, I don't know if that necessarily holds up to, like, the test of logic that well. But it's clever enough on its own terms, and it's a way to get out of it. And it constantly gives Wes Craven the space to trick you repeatedly as to who the murderer really is. I spent the whole time thinking the murderer was going to be the actress that was hired to play Neve Campbell's character, because she kept doing these very oscillating things. I almost get the sense that she was not told what the ending of the movie was going to be, and that probably she did multiple takes of everything she did. Because half the time you feel like she's this idiot damsel in distress, and the other half you feel like she's hiding something, and she's clear, like, her behavior just seems off the whole time. So when you string together all of her performances, you're sort of left in the lurk until she gets brutally murdered. And you guys, okay, guess she's not the murderer.
Yeah, I think they did a pretty just decent job of, like, the misdirect. They do sort of heavily lean into the cop. I think Patrick Dempsey?
Yeah, he very much seems like a killer himself.
They very much lean into, like, the sort of a menacing side of his character. Almost to the, like, the point of, like, hey, he's clearly protesting too much, the writer of this movie. Like, they want you to think it's this guy, so it can't be. But yeah, the Parker Posey character. But I think they did a pretty good job of, like, misdirecting and keeping the camera off of the actual murderer, who it turned out to be. Also, the Miranda Otto character, I was suspecting her for a little while, because she didn't really have a function in the movie. Yeah. She was kind of there for a few scenes. Like, she has to have a reason for being here. Turns out, no, she didn't. So she wasn't the killer.
Yeah. Oh, other big names on the cast, just to get those out of the way. Patrick Warburton's in it.
Yeah.
That's great. That's really fun. He plays the bodyguard. Lance Hendrickson, who's been around a million horror films, he's, like, the film producer in the movie. Patrick Dempsey, you just mentioned. Scott Foley is the villain. Jenny McCarthy has a small role in it, which is fun. And then Liev Schreiber, who is a great actor and director who is above projects like this, thankfully decides to die early in it.
Yeah.
He plays the character Cotton. Cotton was a big deal in the first two movies.
Yeah, and much like at least the first movie, I don't remember much about the second movie, you kind of have one of the bigger names in the movie kind of die within the first scene.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, that was like the thing. Like, it started with a twist, the first Scream movie. Like, you had Drew Barrymore as like this headline actress. She was like front and center in the poster, and then they just kill her off in the first.
Immediately. Yeah. So that's Jenny McCarthy's fate in this one as well.
Hmm. But.
Does anybody make it through all three movies?
Neve Campbell.
Kind of everybody. Like, all the core people do.
Yeah, like, who are the three core? You got Neve Campbell, Courtney Cox.
And David Arquette.
Yeah. They all make it.
Yeah,
because they always do.
They're fine. It's the ones that get off are like a lot of the actors portraying them.
How do they find the killer in these movies? Is it kind of like a Scooby-Doo in the gang kind of thing?
We have a clue! There's always like a showdown or like a reveal. Like, the killer's like, you have to come here because this is where we're all going to have the showdown.
And his exposition of why all of that made sense had to be like 5 to 10 minutes long.
Mm.
Of him just explaining how this works
right
to her rather than just fucking offing her. You know? Like...
I found a lot of the the tropes a bit tired at this point because there were I couldn't count the number of times there was like a killer who makes the phone call and was like bamboozling you into thinking like it was somebody else calling and was like, I'm gonna come kill you was the punchline of that phone call. I was like, okay,
I'm sure
like,
that was at some point.
How many times are you gonna do this?
At some point, Curtis Cox has to be like, how do they keep fighting these fucking voice things?
Yeah,
Sydney.
Neve Campbell just mugs for the camera all the time. She's always making some sort of face, like furrowing her eyebrows or doing some sort of facial expression.
Well, she's got what we would now today call PTSD.
She's seen
so much death.
Uh-huh.
It's wild. This woman would just be like fucking in one of those...
Straight jackets,
man. This woman is amazing that she can fucking just live a normal life in any capacity. Oh, which apparently, at the end of it, that's, totally tacked on there. Her and Patrick Dempsey. Boning.
Yeah. They have that scene, right at the just tag off the entire movie, where they're, back at home, and they're going to watch a movie or something, and,
She's I'm not going to shut the door. And then a little raccoon just comes inside. It's there's no raccoon. But it's Jesus, keep the vermin out.
That was, supposed to be the arc of the character. I'm no longer afraid. I'm going to keep the door open. Bitch, you're letting the air conditioning out. What are you doing? Don't you care about the fucking planet?
You let your bills go be through the roof.
Right. Yeah. Close the door.
Should I be concerned that my mom was a prostitute? That's a heck of a reveal.
Mm.
What's next? One more movie to go. What was it?
Reindeer Games.
Oh, Reindeer Games.
Oh, I did not watch this one.
What? You did? You did?
I did not, no. It's like, so we got a Christmas movie in February, though.
Yeah. Right, that's the thing
Ben
about
Affleck.
It. Yeah, again, and this is my third movie with narration in it. You have unconvincing Ben Affleck explaining what's happening the whole
time.
Oh,
no.
Yeah, it's a... all right, so this guy, John Frankenheimer, is a huge deal in Hollywood. He's been making films since the 60s. He's got, I think, 30-something films to his credit. And he had a ton of success early on filmmaking, where people were like, this guy's an auteur, he's going to be an amazing director. And then his career just kind of has the occasional high point, but then a lot of low points.
Did he do the other, Tom Clancy, Jack Ryan movies?
No, I don't believe so.
Because there was a run throughout, I think it was mostly through the 90s, where this Jack Ryan character, he's kind of become this
Patriot
American
Games
James Bond.
Or whatever.
A couple of them were played by Harrison Ford, and then just had Alec Baldwin in Hunt for the Red October for some reason.
Yeah, I don't think that was him. But I actually did watch a maybe 10-minute video I found on YouTube where Alec Baldwin was talking about John Frankenheimer.
Hmm.
He's talking about what he appreciated about his way of filmmaking. And also, one of the last... So, sadly, if he's making films in the late 60s, that means if he's making a film in the year 2000, he's a much older man, right?
Yeah.
So he died 2 years after making this film. This was his last film that he made. And it has, I think, a 20% on Rotten Tomatoes. He should have stopped at Ronin, because he made Ronin a couple of years prior to this.
Yeah, 98.
Yeah.
I'm looking at his filmography right now. I didn't just know off the top of my head.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, he was, Iceman Cometh, he did, what is it? I can't, Manchurian Candidate was a big film of his early on in his career. Just tons and tons of movies, worked with so many great actors over the years. That's kind of the problem with him, too, is that they've said that he was never able to properly write a woman character. Hmm. All of his stories are very much about the moral conflicts of men. So he writes a lot of stuff about political intrigue, about criminals and things like that, but it's always with the strong male lead in focus. So what is this movie, right? This movie is, it's a noirish film about a con artist, or about basically a car thief who's in jail, who then gets brought into this scheme where they're going to rob a casino that he never actually worked at. Sherlock, okay?
Yeah, he's okay. He probably just woke himself up.
Yeah.
Just the synopsis here on IMDb. No. After assuming his dead cellmate's identity to get with the other man's girlfriend, an ex-convict finds himself a reluctant participant in a casino heist.
I'm bored already.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. So I guess
this sounds like gibberish.
And yeah, and your lead there is Ben Affleck. And frankly, he is not good. He's really bad in this role. I'm not saying Ben Affleck's a bad actor. I'm sure he's got some quality roles that he's portrayed.
Academy Award winner.
This just doesn't suit him well. He's too much of kind of a peach, like a kind of a lovable dope. He doesn't look or feel at all like a car thief that's been in jail. He's got that fucking Superman chin.
What the fuck is this cast, though? What the hell?
Yeah, you also have Gary Sinise, who crushes it in this. Gary Sinise is amazing in this.
He's a very sinister person.
Yeah, and you have Charlize Theron in it, who is portraying the girl that... And again, that's kind of a creeper move, don't you think? And granted, this is the double-cross frenzy that you can kind of predict from just from watching the movie, you're like, okay, everybody's double-crossing everybody. Nobody's believable, nobody's word should be taken at face value. But she's kind of this like sweetheart girl that's been writing to his guy in prison with, who is literally, again, what a fucking cliche, like gets stabbed to death a day before they're supposed to leave prison. Like it's his last day. It's sort of like when the cop's last day on the job, it's like, oh, he's about to get shot to death.
it's like, I got 48 hours to retirement. Oh, you're about to die, my friend.
Oh, man.
That's... Yeah, right. So his cellmate ends up getting stabbed to death in a prison brawl. And this guy keeps talking about how he's going to go hook up with this Charlize Theron's character when he gets out. So, you know, not knowing that this guy died, of course, he then pretends to be him so they can have sex. Yeah, it's a thing you do. You trick a woman into thinking that you're somebody else, and then you have sex with her.
Do you think he did it for his ex-con cellmate? He's like, just pour one out for the homies kind of thing? Bang this chick in his memory?
In the year 2000, that's like a sly, sinister move. In 2021, that is rape.
Yeah, it's very inappropriate, putting on a false pretense like that. But don't worry, it's all a big double-cross, because in a convoluted series of events, that stabbing never actually happened, and the guy's still alive, and he's been double-crossing everybody the whole time.
Okay.
So stupid.
Do you think that this Frankenheim character saw Wild Things and was like, I need to make a movie like that?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, yeah, he does talk to Charlize Theron out of her top in it, so at least that happens. But yeah, it's... And again, like...
I mean, we're passing over the other thing. It's got like Danny Trejo and yes. Donald Logue.
TV show where he was Irish and has
Ashton Kutcher is in here as some college kid.
Really?
Ashton Kutcher.
I don't remember him in that.
Yeah, he's in there.
Damn.
Just random people. Ron Perkins is in there somewhere. Like, where are these? Ron Jeremy? Like, just random fucking...
That's the second movie we've talked about with Ron Jeremy in it this year.
Yeah, he's in here somewhere.
And none of them have been pornographic.
This is a weird thing. IMDb, it's got this Douglas Arthurs. I don't really know who the guy is, but his picture on there is of a character he played in a Riddick movie.
Whoa!
It's the weirdest coincidence in Riddick 2.
All right, that is
him in the Riddick 2 outfit.
That is very, very strange. Guys... I think we're being Truman showed.
That's the weirdest. Yeah.
I notice how I'm constantly being rerouted in traffic.
Mm. Yeah, and that that spotlight did fall from the sky the other day.
Oh, that was just me. You got it coming, man. Get you one of these days. Like the fucking Roadrunner. No, but I guess the
point, all right.
Put a button on it, right? This movie is very well shot. I mean, there's this is a hard-boiled noir, right? So, like, every once in a while, Frankenheimer just gives you a gorgeous shot. He has a really good way of getting right up in characters' faces. So you really see a lot of detailed expressions on these actors. I mean, for it's an old school noir thing to see a shot like what he does, but for that alone, I mean, it's gorgeous in its way. But the plot, I just can't get behind this plot. You know, you've got a couple of great performances, but premise is terrible, and Ben Affleck cannot carry this thing. He's not any good. I don't know who would have done this well, though, is the thing. This is such a bad
character. Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yeah. It's like this guy's supposed to be a...
let's give him...
It's supposed to be a car thief that's been in jail for 5 years, and he looks like he's coming from a fucking Gillette commercial.
Yep, Vin Diesel. Yep, this is it. Yep, this is Vin Diesel.
Vin Diesel sitting in a car, shaving his head with a knife.
Actually, yeah, Vin Diesel wouldn't be so bad, honestly. He would have been better at this than I think.
Too bad he was making Pitch Perfect.
Pitch Black.
No, he's doing that too. He's doing Pitch Perfect too. Yeah. Oh, where did that come from?
Yeah, we're probably not too far off from him doing like Triple X. Anyway,
I would love to watch Ben Affleck and Vin Diesel just switch roles that month. I would love to see Ben Affleck in Pitch Black. How'd you get those eyes?
Stupid goggles?
I would love to see that.
I think that works.
Does he shave his head?
Oh, you'd have to.
Oh, yeah, that's part of the role.
Yeah, that chin dimple alone. I think absorbs light.
All right. I think we're off the range here.
I think so. Did anything else happen in February 2000, or can we just stop?
No, that's it. There's nothing. So, the last retro show, I said I was going to talk about the 12, the X-Men event. I'm not going to talk about it. First of all, because we can go for 2 hours. Second of all, because I did not read it again. So, I have not done a summary of it.
Mini show.
So, what I'm going to propose is we haven't gotten any Pokemon news yet. We haven't done a Pokemon show. So, next week, unless there is some big Pokemon news that we think can fill an episode.
Oh, I think the big thing is supposed to happen at the very end of the month. I think I heard that there was like some kind of big community day that was planned.
Yeah. There's some sort of event or some hints or rumors at some sort of Pokemon announcement. And the Pokemon Company and Game Freak have said that they have things that they want to announce. They have some stuff that they want to do for 2021 because of a Pokemon anniversary. But who knows? Like maybe just like some events within games. Maybe it's a new game. We don't really know anything substantial yet.
Yeah.
But so if for some reason they announce something we want to talk about, we can do that. But next week, in lieu of a Pokemon show, I was thinking we could talk about some X-Men. But also something that we never do, which maybe we just should at this point. Nintendo had their Q3 financial reports.
Ooh.
And it might be kind of fun to break that all down in detail because they made just a fuck ton of money. They're just printing it over there.
Nice.
So, rather than address that on an official show with news, because, you know, it's not really like news, like how much money they made and how many copies of things they sold. Like, it doesn't affect us in any sort of substantial way.
Can we get those green visors?
Yes, we would have to.
Nice.
I like those really loud calculators.
Yeah, so you got a 10 key calculator.
Yeah.
I do sell those at Target.
The visors or the calculator? With the tape and the carbon paper?
Yeah.
Well, I have one at my desk. Wait, I haven't been in my office since almost a year now, but I have one at my desk at work that I like very much.
Do you think it's still there?
Yeah.
The desk? You think your desk is still there?
Yeah, I think the building's still there. Yeah, I would assume all of the stuff is in it. You know, it's just been...
It's been looted.
It's waiting for us to come out of cryospace. We'll all get to use it again. No, it's expensive, too. It's like $100. Those things are not cheap.
No, they're not.
Steal some for us.
What?
We'll have a heist.
Just for a gag on a podcast, I'll commit crime.
Yeah, we'll 5 minutes in, we'll realize it's way too noisy. And
just throw away anyways.
Well, this was fun.
Well, you don't have to run the tape. There's a little thing you can do to turn off the tape.
Okay.
Yeah. I literally like
this. I knew there was a reason why we kept you on this show, Ryan.
Because of my knowledge of 10-key calculators.
Yep, that was it.
Can I tell all about Bloomberg terminals?
All right, well, that's what we'll do then. So unless anything big happens with Pokemon, we'll just talk about some Nintendo monies and some X-Men, and that'll be a show.
So long!
You jumped the gun.
I did it.
You've already said goodbye. You can't say anything else. Dear. And then we'll wrap it all up at the end of the month at the official show. We'll talk about some news and some new games. Talk about some games coming out in March. That'll be fun. There's some cool stuff coming out in March.
Great.
But that's the end. Till next time.
Das Vidanya.
So long.